This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we pay tribute to our colleague and friend, journalist Glenn Ford.
Glenn Ford is certainly presente. Black Agenda Report continues under the able leadership of Margaret Kimberly, and we're fortunate enough to have a recording of the great speech that Glenn gave in 2014 at Riverside Church, and then we're going to rebroadcast an interview we did with Glenn.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
Glenn Ford died last July 28th of lung cancer. I knew Glenn the last 7 years of his life. I first met him in 2014 after a speech that he gave at New York's Riverside Church on the occasion of the 7th anniversary of the Black Agenda Report, of which he was the executive editor. The two other editors were Margaret Kimberly, who has taken over as the editor, and the late Bruce Dixon of Chicago, who died 2 years ago. They were a formidable threesome. That night, Glenn spoke about what he called the Black Misleadership Class, a description he coined, and how it was an enemy of the movement. He said the Democratic Party, which they populate, was not the lesser of two evils, but the most effective of two evils. In particular, he zeroed in on New Jersey Senator Cory Booker. I kept in touch with Glenn. He was a guest on Law and Disorder several times. I helped him assemble a selection of his writings called The Black Agenda, which will very soon be published by Orr Books. 2 months ago, the publisher of Orr Books, Colin Robinson, and I drove out to New Jersey to visit Glenn. He had just gotten out of the hospital where they took fluid out of his cancerous lung. He was somewhat frail, but pretty chipper. We ate bagels and cream cheese at the dining room table and talked politics for 2 hours. As we left, Colin remarked that it was a shame we hadn't recorded our conversation. Glenn was that brilliant. Glenn was the real thing, a black nationalist and a socialist, as he described himself. He was a former Black Panther and usually wore a black beret when he spoke. He ended his speeches with his right arm held high in the air, saying, "Power to the people." Heidi, tell us something about his background.
Michael, for over half a century, Glenn provided a moral voice among progressive black journalists. He began his career as a radio news reporter in Georgia and later as a TV and online correspondent. Glenn's upbringing informed his lifelong ethos and vocation. His mother was an Irish-American communist and civil rights activist, and his father was a disc jockey known on air as the Deuce, who associated with singers such as James Brown, Aretha Franklin, and Jackie Wilson. Glenn and three colleagues from BlackCommentator.com left in 2006 to found, as you mentioned, the Black Agenda Report. It was run on a tight budget, and it was fiercely independent and is a highly respected news outlet. Years before, in 1977, Glenn co-founded America's Black Forum, the first nationally syndicated black news TV interview program. Dozens of local stations carried it, including WJLA, the ABC affiliate in Washington. And it brought people not often given a national platform to speak together, including Communist Party leaders and welfare rights activists. As you know, Glenn was a vocal critic of the black political leadership. That included President Barack Obama and now Senator Cory Booker. He called them out for failing to address the interests of economically disadvantaged black Americans and in their accepting money from big corporations. We will sorely miss Glenn, but on a positive note, he has left an enduring legacy and he has set a very high bar for journalistic integrity.
We go now back to 2014 to hear the speech that Glenn Ford gave on the occasion of the 7th anniversary of Black Agenda Report.
To begin this program, which is put together around the theme of the Black Misleadership Class, I think that two words would suffice to introduce the subject of Black misleadership class. And those words are Cory Booker, whose name is, of course, on everyone's lips. Just this week, of course, Cory Booker was elected, or became the senator-elect from New Jersey. Last night, I was flipping around through the channels, and I stumbled, totally by mistake, of course, upon Fox TV. And I saw that the crew was busy trying to explain how Cory Booker was such a liberal tax and spend politician who would favor urban areas, meaning Black, over suburban areas of New Jersey, meaning white. And that is just so far from the truth, it is laughable, because Cory Booker is the politician who was bought and paid for by the same institutions, the same money bags that are just as white and far to the right as Fox News itself. In point of historical fact, Booker's political career was birthed in the womb of the right-wing Bradley Foundation out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And you don't get any more reactionary than that. The Bradley Foundation was so far to the right and so good at doing far-right things that it was dubbed by President Bush his favorite foundation. And he wasn't kidding about that. They did him some great service. They contributed to two of his most important domestic policies. One of them was called the Faith-Based Initiative, which was essentially a scheme designed to bribe a whole class of Black preachers. And Black preachers are, of course, a very important component of the Black misleadership class, as Dr. West would explain if he hadn't had this personal tragedy. Bush's faith-based initiative had Black preachers lined up, literally thousands of them, to get a federal gift. And in return, those preachers would either become Republicans or endorse Republican policies. That was the product of the Bradley Foundation and the think tanks that it funds. The other gift that the Bradley Foundation gave to the Bush administration was the campaign for private school vouchers. And that campaign was very quickly expanded into an all-out push for charter schools, which did even more widespread destruction. And that is the point where Cory Booker comes in. Cory Booker had just turned 30, and he was in his first year of his first term in the Newark City Council, where, by the way, and I used to cover the Newark City Council for a small Black newspaper that I helped found, and nobody on the City Council paid much attention to Cory Booker. He was there at the first meeting, the founding gathering, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, under the auspices of the Bradley Foundation, for a front group that they had specifically formed in order to try and create the impression that there was a movement out there among Black folks for private school vouchers. Now, the reality was that private school vouchers had never been an issue in the Black community. If people were familiar at all with private school vouchers, it was in the context of them being used in order to fund segregation academies in the Deep South during the time of massive resistance. But the Bradley Foundation reasoned that with their millions and millions of dollars, they could create a movement or the semblance of one out of thin air. All they had to do was attract a gaggle of hustlers and scoundrels, Black hustlers and scoundrels, and call them the thinkers and movers and shakers of a new movement, and it would be so. And all they had to do was tell the the corporate media that this was a legitimate movement of black people, and they would cover it that way. And Cory Booker was at that first meeting of this Black Alliance of for Educational Options in 1998. Also on hand was Floyd Flake. He was the congressman from Queens who, before he resigned, was the only member of the Congressional Black Caucus who ever supported school vouchers. Floyd Flake went on to become an important cog in the wheel of the Manhattan Institute. All of you are familiar with that right-wing outfit, and to make millions as a practitioner of charter schools. Flake and Booker are part of a black misleadership class, however, one that is totally bought and paid for, created out of whole cloth by the corporate world. 3 years later, after Cory got his real political beginnings, after he put together the source of his funding, he made his first run for mayor of Newark, New Jersey. That was in 2002. He was backed with millions of dollars in campaign funds from that same universe of right-wingers that he had met through the Bradley Foundation. Even the right-wing columnist George F. Will came to Newark to support Cory Booker. This is how Cory Booker was set on the path to becoming a major black political figure as a wholly owned subsidiary of the most reactionary forces in the United States, as a pure servant of corporate power. And that year was 2002. That's when we first called attention at Black Commentator. Black Commentator was the predecessor to Black Agenda Report, and that's where the core of the Black Agenda Report team came together. And back in 2002, we were the first to call attention to the great danger that was represented not just by Cory Booker, but to all of these newly empowered hustlers and scoundrels who were being funded by the corporate world. That was the first issue, in fact, of the Black Commentator, the cover story for that first issue. It was called Fruit of the Poison Tree. The core team of Black Agenda Report has actually been documenting the rise of this new cohort of black corporate politicians for more than a decade, not just the 7 years that we're celebrating tonight of Black Agenda Report. The black misleadership class is nothing new. It did not begin in 1998 or in 2002 or even with this surge of corporate funding. It has always been there. It has existed in some form as long as there has been a Black America. It is a class that sees its own personal, financial, and social interests as being synonymous with the progress of Black people as a whole. This class does not seek transformation of society. It seeks only their own elevation within the existing structures. The rest of Black America, as far as they are concerned, is supposed to applaud their individual success. And we're also supposed to call that Black progress, no matter what is actually happening to the masses of Black people at the bottom. It is the politics of putting black faces in high places and to hell with those of us stuck at the bottom, or those of us who are below the bottom in the U.S. prison gulag. This black misleadership class has always been among us, and it is the tension between these representationists, these who see only the goal of being represented, that is, having a few black folks in business and in motion pictures, and maybe one day, now is the day, in the White House, but do not see the need for a transformation of society. What's new is the massive influx of national corporate money to black Democrats, That is the transformation that occurred at the turn of the 21st century, and resulting in not just Cory Booker's candidacy, but others as well. It all begins in 2002 with Cory Booker's first campaign for mayor and the corporate-funded unseating of Cynthia McKinney in Atlanta and of Earl Hilliard in Alabama. These campaigns were funded by the same people that put Cory Booker up for office the first time. Corporate money transformed the black electoral politics game, just as corporate money subverted the old line black civic and civil rights organizations and made them into willing partners with the very same Wall Street banks that were, back in 2002, beginning to target every black neighborhood in the nation with subprime mortgages. That is when that offensive began as well. Corporate America begins the 21st century with a massive money offensive in black America, and they were successful beyond their wildest dreams. They knew that they had a future star in Cory Booker, and they're so happy today. They're celebrating. Their boy is going to the Senate. But back in 2002, they were also vetting another and much more talented and much more promising front man for Capitol. And his name was Barack Obama. He was beginning his campaign for the Senate from Illinois. We at Black Agenda Report, or rather at Black Commentator when the team was there, we confronted Obama for a solid month in June of 2003, Bruce Dixon and I. We had an intense back and forth exchange with Brother Obama, which you can still read in the pages of the Black Commentator. We knew that Obama was a nightmare that was about to happen, but we did let him slide. We hoped that we could somehow avoid denouncing this up-and-coming young man that so many people found so attractive. But of course, it didn't work that way. We couldn't avoid him for long. It was Barack Obama who wound up moving forward and astonishingly, in astonishing speed, Cory Booker's and the Bradley Foundation's agenda on the privatization of public schools. And one of Obama's first acts was to expand the faith-based initiatives. So we have the Bradley Foundation's initiative living on with Obama, just as the Heritage Foundation's legacy lives on in Obamacare. Cory Booker has gone on to climb into bed with every money bag in the Silicon Valley. But Barack Obama is the commander-in-chief of global capitalism, the imperial maestro with a kill list that has everybody's name and everybody's address on it, along with all of your social and political networks and friends. And all of this has been done with a black face. The transformation in black politics over the last 10 years has been staggering. It has been absolutely breathtaking. In 2002, when George Bush asked the U.S. Congress for war powers in order to attack Iraq, only 4 members of the Congressional Black Caucus voted in favor. Our team at the Black Commentator called these 4 people the 4 eunuchs of war. Now fast forward just 9 years to 2011, in the age of Obama, fully half of the Congressional Black Caucus, 20 members, voted against a resolution that would have halted the U.S. bombing of an African nation, Libya. This is an outcome that would have been unthinkable under George Bush just a few years before. It was even more grotesque when it's remembered that while these 20 black members of Congress were voting to continue bombing Libya, President Obama's jihadist rebel friends were carrying out a race war on the ground in Libya, purging the country of black Libyans and African migrants and massacring them by the thousands. But that didn't change the minds of half of the Congressional Black Caucus. Only a decade earlier, in 2003, just 6 weeks before the Iraq War began, the Zogby poll did a survey that found that only 21% of blacks supported an attack on Iraq. Huge majorities at the same time of white men were for the war, and majorities of white women and nearly half of Hispanics were also for a war against Iraq. But when the Zogby poll asked the question, would you support an invasion of Iraq if it would result in the death of thousands of Iraqi civilians, only 7% of blacks said yes. And that was a reaffirmation of what pollsters had found consistently ever since blacks have been included in the polling process. They have found that African Americans are the group most consistently opposed to U.S. military adventures abroad. And that is because, historically, we have not trusted the motives of the United States. And we never have. That is, until a black man came to sit in the White House. And suddenly, those motives were seen as benign. Now, fast forward again to September of this year. For the first time in history, more blacks said they were in favor of war than whites did. This has never happened before. 40% of blacks surveyed by the ABC Washington Post poll said they were in favor of a military strike against Syria. Only 38% of whites said so, and only 31% of Hispanics were in favor. The question then raised is this a repudiation by a sizable proportion of black folks of the historical black consensus on peace and on social justice? I don't think that it is a repudiation, but right now we can't prove whether it is or not. What is clear is that the age of Obama is offering up the worst role models in black American history, and a black political class that is quite willing to consign the black consensus on peace to the dustbin of history in order to defend a black presence in the highest office in the land. So go bomb the Libyans and go bomb the Syrians. We got a black man in the White House. What does it matter? A significant proportion of the black population is willing to go along with almost any program as long as they feel that they are acting or expressing opinions that are in defense of Obama. I'm going to leave you with one more horrific factoid. Fully one-third of the black caucus recently voted to maintain the NSA's spying program on all Americans. And to think, one-third of the caucus, people who are representing black communities that are suffering mass incarceration and have been suffering mass incarceration for the last 40 years. And we understand that the beginning of the process of mass incarceration is hyper-surveillance of the black community. And yet this one-third of the black caucus votes for hyper-surveillance of all Americans. This is a monstrous deformity of black politics, and it has occurred over just the last 10 years. It's rooted in the huge onslaught of corporate money into black democratic politics and in the suborning by corporations of traditional black organizations. There is no movement to act as a countervailing force to the power of capital. And when there is no mass movement, the self-serving black misleadership class becomes even more influential internally in black America. Black Agenda Report exists to play a role in the rebuilding of a mass black movement. And if there is no rebuilding of a mass black movement, there is little hope of any effective progressive resistance to the rule of Wall Street and its servants in government and for peace. Some of you may say, Glenn, why all this lamentation? I thought this was supposed to be a celebration of Black Agenda's 7th anniversary, and you ain't smiled yet. But I think that we are celebrating. We're celebrating the fact that we are still here fighting the power every day. And that more and more people of all races are recognizing the real dimensions of the crisis and the character and nature of the crisis. We're celebrating the fact that there still exists a critical mass of people who are struggling to reestablish and repair the black historical consensus for social justice and peace. And some of the most outstanding personalities in that struggle are right here with us tonight. We promised you a productive and worthwhile evening. Power to the people.
That was Glenn Ford speaking at the Black Agenda Report 7th Anniversary of Riverside Church.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
The Chinese word for crisis consists of two characters. One means danger, the other means opportunity. We currently are in an historically unprecedented situation fraught with both danger and opportunity. The great Russian revolutionary Vladimir Lenin once remarked that sometimes nothing happens in decades, and other times decades happen in a few weeks. This is our situation now. We see an American spring unfolding. The public lynching of George Floyd has triggered massive outpourings in several thousands of American cities, both large and small. Black Lives Matter is supported by a majority of Americans, including a majority of whites. This kind of broad solidarity was absent during the time of Martin Luther King. The demonstrations are in large part led by people of color, mostly young people. Elected officials and traditional civil rights leaders are not leading the current uprising. As the LA Progressive has written, the gross underlying inequality, racially and more broadly economically, affects every aspect of life in the U.S. and is the root cause of the volcanic anger erupting against the veneer of obsolete institutions. We speak today with Glenn Ford, the editor of the prestigious Black Agenda Report, about the unfolding movement, where it came from, and where it might be heading. Ford founded the Black Agenda Report and has edited it since 2006. He was a founding member of the Washington chapter of the National Association of Black Journalists, and he has spoken at scores of colleges and universities. Glenn Ford, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
Let's talk about the position of many politicians that police reforms like wearing of body cameras or more training or the outlawing of chokeholds, that this will curb police abuse. What's your view on these reforms? Will they really curb police abuse?
Well, of course, we all are in favor, in principle, with most of those reforms, but understand what these politicians are doing is protecting the police, protecting them by getting rid of those behaviors and policies that have come under the greatest attack. But they're not going to be cooperative in any demand for reallocation of power. that is, to make the police truly accountable. They use that word all the time, accountability, but accountability is a power relationship, and that they don't want to tamper with.
So how do you appreciate the demand to abolish the police? Angela Davis has articulated that. Critics respond that we'll be unsafe if we abolish the police. Would we?
Well, we don't just abolish the police. We replace the police. And in the interim, between the actual physical replacement of the police, you exercise decisive power over not just what they do day to day, that is, overseeing them to see that they don't commit excessive infractions, which is what oversight seems to be these days, but you shape what policing is in America. That means, in fact, that most of the cops who presently are on the job have been mistrained, have joined the police force for all the worst reasons, and will have to be replaced. So this is a huge undertaking that requires real, not just community input, but community mobilization for the power to reshape the police so that we don't even call them police anymore. It requires that the people take part in their own security. That is a tremendous popular mobilization project that has to go along with the demands. So, no, you don't just get rid of the police overnight. There would be a huge backlash if that ever happened, and it won't. But if it ever did, there'd be a huge backlash from the black community itself, because the security problem, and everyone has security concerns all over the world, the security question would not be addressed. But we must address that security question. And so it's fine and necessary to state the principle and the long-range goal of disbanding the police, but that demand itself calls forth a whole arena of work and study to find out what kind of work we should be doing. The project cries out to be filled out.
So what's the role, I mean the real role, apart from they say that they're keeping us safe, I don't believe that. What's the real role of the police in our class society?
Oh, it's the protection of property and privilege. And in a racist society, that means white property, oligarchs' property, and white privilege. That has been their function the entire time. They have not stepped away from that imperative. In fact, they've doubled down, which is what militarization of the police, federal intervention in policing, which was always marketed as a kind of reform. People had it in their heads, and they were encouraged to think that this kind of reform would get rid of, make passé and obsolete the Dodge Sheriff figure, you know, the pot-bellied Dodge Sheriff, Southern, of course, who lorded it over black folks and called on his good old boys to help to reinforce him if they thought black folks got out of line. Everybody wanted to get rid of that. But the real result of federal intervention beginning in 1968 with the passage of the LEAA, the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration Bill. That federal intervention and all the rest that have followed under the mass black incarceration regime have, in fact, made the imperative of keeping black folks in line, protecting white privilege and property even more intense, more fatal, much more like a police state. In fact, when you talk about the United States, it's not like a police state. It is the archetype of a police state in the modern capitalist world.
So how would you ensure public safety if the police are abolished?
Well, just as the Black Panther Party proposed back in 68-69, the people should police themselves or choose the instruments of their own security. That is a self-determination question. It's a question of democracy. And the immediate answer in today to that question is community control of police. And in Chicago, they have by far the most developed community control of police campaign in the whole country. They've had a bill for community control of the police since 2012, I believe, and through some wonderful redirection of street protest power into an intervention in the electoral system. Now in Chicago, 19 of the 50 city councilmen, board of aldermen, now support community control of the police. The mayor, the new black woman mayor, of course, is a longtime friend and supporter of the Chicago police. And she's the biggest impediment at the moment. So people ought to be looking at what's been happening in Chicago. They've been wrestling with this question for a very, very long time, inspired by the police state murder of Fred Hampton. The best analysis can be found there.
The mayor promised when she was running for office that she would be active in doing this, and yet she's not done a thing, not a single thing. Meanwhile, they've got a bill up in front of city council to provide for an elected community group that would monitor the police. I mean, that would be real community control of the police. So we'll see how that fares. Are you aware of what they're doing with that bill, Glenn?
Sure. That's the CPAC bill. That's the current iteration of the bill that was put together, as I said, back in 2012. And they've been pushing it ever since. What the mayor says, as she retreated from her campaign position, she now says that defunding of the police, that's not community control, but that defunding of the police is a bad thing because it would result in the laying off of minority police. Who have less seniority. She's hiding behind the color issue in order, in fact, to protect the police.
Yeah, it reminds me of the saying that if you got a boot on your neck, it doesn't matter whether there's a brown foot inside of the boot.
If the police are an army of occupation in the black community, the color of the soldiers in that army is not really that important. What's important is the mission of that army of occupation, and that mission is to terrorize, pacify, and contain all of the black community. And that is, in fact, the general principle of the mass black incarceration regime that was imposed in the late 60s as a reaction to the black rebellions of that decade.
What is the position, Glenn Ford, of the Democratic Party respecting police abuse? I read recently that Joe Biden suggested that people be shot in the legs rather than in the chest.
Mass black incarceration, the creation of a militarized police state has always been a thoroughly bipartisan affair. With the imposition of the mass black incarceration regime, first with measures that came under the umbrella of the drug war back in 68-69. Well, the LEAA, which I explained earlier, was key to that, and that was introduced under the Johnson administration. The crime bill of 1994 was, of course, a creation of the Bill Clinton administration, an administration in which Joe Biden was deeply involved. And he claims, I don't know if it's really true, but he claims that he wrote the bill. So this is a bipartisan scheme to continue the containment and terrorization of and criminalization of the black community. And Joe Biden's hands are bloodier than most.
Malik Mia has written in Green Left Weekly that the demand to abolish the current police force is step one. community control, independent prosecutors, and the creation of a safety force must follow to revolutionize policing. Can you elaborate on that, please?
No, that's a little bit backwards, and activists can argue about it. But of course, it's backwards. You're not going to abolish a police department and then get community control. It really doesn't work that way. As others have pointed out, if there is a vacuum under capitalism in security for property, then the people with property are going to buy their security. If the public's not going to provide the policing that the oligarchs want, then the oligarchs and even white neighborhood associations will then contract with private security firms. And we know this will occur. We saw it in New Orleans with Katrina. As soon as there was no effective police because the police were either stranded or had left town themselves, then we saw this huge influx of private security firms, including not just Blackwater, the villainous mercenary outfit based in the U.S., but Israeli security firms, all of them descending on New Orleans. You would have that kind of situation if you willy-nilly disbanded before establishing black community control or community control. That's what you'd see. But that's not going to happen. If it did happen, however, you'd have almost the worst of all possible worlds with these private mercenaries now stalking and acting in predatory fashion in the black community.
Elected officials and traditional civil rights leaders are not leading the current uprising. New young leaders, many of them people of color, have stepped up. How do you appreciate that phenomena?
Well, almost all the elected leaders of the black community are, of course, Democrats. And they take their orders from the Democratic Party and from Nancy Pelosi. So we saw the farcical spectacle of Nancy Pelosi surrounded by her minions in the Congressional Black Caucus, putting on kente cloth and taking a knee in the Capitol grounds in some kind of symbolic act of solidarity. But we have to talk about who that was surrounding Nancy Pelosi. In 2014, 2 months before Michael Brown was shot down in Ferguson, Missouri, the Grayson Amendment was on the House floor. The Grayson Amendment would have halted, abolished the Pentagon's 1033 program. The 1033 program is the federal program, the main one, for militarization of the police. It funnels billions of dollars in military weapons and gear and sometimes training to local police departments. And it was up for a vote. In that vote, 30 members of the Congressional Black Caucus voted to keep the 1033 program going. Only 8 voted against it. That means 80% of the Congressional Black Caucus voted to continue the militarization of the police. That included William Clay, who was Michael Brown's congressman, Michael Brown being the young man shot down in Ferguson, Missouri in August of 2014, setting off what came to be called the Black Lives Matter movement. But those same Congressional Black Caucus members, having gone through the first iteration of the Black Lives Matter movement, seemed to have learned nothing at all. It was as if the movement never existed, because in 2018, 75% of the Congressional Black Caucus voted to make the police a protected class, that is, protected like people of color are protected under the law, and voted an assault against police should be a federal hate crime. Of course, you know, everybody knows that when the police kick your butt, they always charge you with assault. So now you'll be eligible for another 5 years in prison for committing a federal hate crime because the cops charged you with assault. But this is what that Congressional Black Caucus does, and they have the nerve to bend a knee and kneel along with their boss lady as if they are in solidarity with any movement against the police.
You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. Our guest today is Glenn Ford, the founder and editor of Black Agenda Report. The Democrats in both the House and the Senate oppose the demand to defund or especially abolish the police. They place their hopes in electing Joe Biden. What would that mean for Black Lives Matter if Joe Biden is elected?
Oh, you know, people speculate. The left speculates about this all the time, whether it's better for the movement if a right-wing racist Republican is in power or if a Democrat is in power. And lots of my friends say that, well, it's better when Democrats are in power because then they have to face up to and defend the status quo rather than when they're out of power, pretend that they're not defenders of the status quo. I really don't like to engage in that kind of speculation because usually it's engaged in as an excuse to drop everything and vote for the Democrat, whoever that is. And I see no value in getting involved in that.
Do you think that the movement should focus on the election, or do you believe that social change comes from someplace else, from below?
Well, we already saw that it comes from somewhere else, from below. We had hundreds of thousands of people in the streets in the George Floyd protests. Those protests and occupations still continue. And we saw the reaction of the ruling class. You can see what the ruling class's reaction is through the reaction of their media. That's the ruling class media. And through the reaction of the corporate duopoly. And so they all basically folded or pretended to fold to these demands, but not in substance. That is, they conceded that police brutality, yes, does exist, that it is directed disproportionately at Black people, and that the problem is systemic. That they have finally accepted. In fact, it's now part of their regular spiel, and they've enlisted all their corporate people, and they're giving lots of money to Black Lives Matter and all kinds of other organizations in order to pretend that they're down with systemic change. But what they're really trying to do, of course, is to blunt the change, to say we have been now convinced now by you that there is a problem, therefore you can leave it up to us to solve. By doing that, they hope to blunt any empowerment demands, which is what the next order of the day, like community control of police. They want you to leave the solution in their hands because they've been converted. They're born again. They're on your side.
We're speaking with Glenn Ford of Black Agenda Report. Glenn, social consciousness and confidence, especially among youth, is growing. Participation in the mass movement has caused that. Beyond police abolition, what other demands do you anticipate are going to come to the fore?
All of them will come to the fore. You know, I think, and I can't prove it, but I'm sure of it, the huge white participation, young white people especially, in this round of protests, and in fact, they numerically dominated in lots of places. You know, there were protests everywhere in the United States, including places where there were very few Black people. There are only 14 Black Lives Matter chapters in the United States. Most big cities don't have one. And yet demonstrations, protests of all kinds were everywhere with the participation of huge numbers of white kids. And I think that is a direct result of Bernie Sanders being forced out or bowing out of his race for the Democratic presidential nomination. That race, beginning in 2016 and continuing this year, had raised the expectations of millions of young people of the possibility of making some kind of important changes in the United States through the electoral process. But the nonstop 24/7 beatdown that the corporate media and the Democratic Party inflicted on Bernie, resulting finally in him bowing out and scurrying over into the Biden camp and acting like we're all in this together. I think that caused millions of his young white supporters to say, no, street is where it's at. I think those kids, many of them, wanted to be in the streets even as they supported Bernie, but they didn't want to embarrass the candidate. Well, he unleashed them and freed them when he bowed out. I think that is responsible for much of the disproportionate, in terms of black-led movements, white participation.
Glenn, we've got time, unfortunately, for only two more questions, and I wanted to ask you the penultimate question. Malcolm X profoundly understood that, as he put it, you can't have capitalism without racism. Do you think more and more people are making that connection?
Yeah, and we're seeing more and more people using the term racial capitalism, as if it's one word, in fact, racial capitalism. There is a question whether capitalism, in theory, can work without racism, but that's not how capitalism developed. In the United States in particular, but it applies to all of the imperial countries, the United States would not be the United States, would not have been able to produce all that capital from the super exploitation of slaves and become, before the turn of the 20th century, a major world economic power. In 1850, 10 years before the Civil War, the value, market value of slaves was the biggest asset of the United States, bigger than every other asset, all the railroads, all the industries, everything else except the land of the United States itself. And that the land of those slave states was in fact overvalued. It was valuable only because it was worked by slaves. So this capitalism has always been racial, and Britain would not be the position of the center of world capital until overtaken by the United States, except for its super exploitation, people in India and Africa and elsewhere in the world. So capitalism's always been racial, and it's only theoretical whether it could exist otherwise.
Glenn, how can people contact Black Agenda Report and follow your work?
Well, they can go to Black Agenda Report easily and see a new issue every Wednesday by visiting blackagendareport.com. But all of our editors, me included, we all list our email addresses at the bottom of each story that we write. So you can also contact us directly.
Thanks, Glenn. One last question before we have to say goodbye. People will be listening to this program the week of the 4th of July. And my last question for you is, what does the 4th of July mean to you?
Oh, you know, you made an easy one there. All you have to do, the best statement on the 4th of July ever, never to be surpassed, was Frederick Douglass's speech on what is the 4th of July to me, delivered in, I believe, Rochester, New York, in the 1850s. It reams the United States out with the most artistic, if that's the right word, language ever employed against a villain.
He was an eloquent man. Glenn Ford, it's great to have you on Law & Disorder. Keep up your good work on Black Agenda Report, and we're sure to have you back as a guest in the near future. You take it easy, Glenn Ford, and thank you so much.
Thank you, brother. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.